Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Stacy from Sunlight of the Spirit.
Okay, I'm standing with a microphone. Okay. Hi, I'm Stacy, I'm an alcoholic. Okay. I'm really, really nervous. Everybody says that, right? But I'm like standing and on a microphone, so it's not helping. Good night. Sorry. I'm sorry. Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. All right. Our speaker, that's always tough. Always, like I've done it before. The idea of that is tough. I just said I can't stand my voice after a couple minutes. You might not be able to stand my voice after a couple minutes. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. March 30th, 2018 is my sober date. And Sunlight of the Spirit is my home group. I've gone through the steps. I've gone through other steps many times, again and again. When I need a checkup, and I've taken another one through the steps. And it's been the greatest 4.5 years of my life. And like as more recently as like the blessings of being sober, and not just being sober, but like finally fulfilling who I was meant to be because I got out of the way. With that, the blessings have just showered over myself and my kids and my family, and it ripples. It's not just me. I get sober and all these things happen to me and for me, but because those things are happening to me and for me, it's also then rippling into the lives of everybody else that I come in contact with, and especially all of those people whom I had spent a long time destroying. So the normal stats, right? I have two older brothers, a much younger sister, mom, dad, they were married. I guess I was 19, 20. So they were married, you know, most of my life. And most of my life, I'm a lot older than 20. That's fine. We'll talk about that later, maybe. From the outside, we all had blonde hair and blue eyes and it all looked perfect. We literally had a white picket fence, yellow house, and, inside that house though, it was a lot of kind of torture and turmoil and brokenness. All of us, I realized so going through the amends process, when I'm thinking like everybody, well before I was ready to make my amends, I thought I need everybody to understand me, I need everybody to see my side, I need validation, I need you to get why I'm so messed up, and it's because of all of you. By the time I was ready to make my amends, I was open to a different possibility, and I had learned a whole lot more about myself, and learned that so much of what was going on was about myself, that I learned that my brothers and sisters, although we lived under the same roof, they weren't going to understand what I went through because we all had a different experience in the house because we're all different people. And you know, my one brother is 7 years older than me. So the way my parents were, acted, behaved at that time in his life was very different than how it was by the time I came around. Very different than it was by the time my little sister came around. So what I was able to do is answer questions, listen to them, and by the end of that, we all had that understanding. We all had that validation. All of those things that were separating us as siblings because all of us blamed each other when in actuality it had to do with the parents. I'm going to talk about things, and I always do, but usually just in like 20 minutes. And I skip over it quick. And I'm going to still skip over a lot of things quickly. But there's things that I talk about, it can seem very dramatic. And a lot of it is tough and rough and hard things to talk about. But when I first started, I was told, for the first time I ever spoke, just tell the truth. Just tell the truth. Everybody's like, oh my God, I'm so nervous. I can't do it. Just tell the truth. You'll be fine. Just tell the truth. So just beforehand, I said, okay, I'm going to tell the truth, but I'm not going to tell them this stuff. And then I opened my mouth and things just started to come out. And it not only felt, once like the dust settled and I was stopping vulnerable, feeling vulnerable, you do the whole like, oh, I should have said this, oh, I shouldn't have said that. Once that was over, I felt relieved. I didn't have any walls to hide behind anymore. Everything was down. And what had happened also was the people that reached out to me, the people that asked for my phone number, the women I was able to help, the men I was even able to help by opening my mouth. So I will talk about some of these things, and the main purpose is to see that this could be, life could be like this. It doesn't have to stay like this. It can be like this. I'm not crying already. I was sexually abused, physically abused, mentally abused by my father. Those are my first memories in life. And my mother knew about it. And so then she eventually was physically, mentally abusive. And once I got old enough, I started just fighting back. So literally fist fighting my father. To a degree, I kind of let my mom keep getting away with it because I felt like I was the one to blame. My dad's doing this to me. It's got to be about me. I'm making him do this. She knows about it. It's hurting her. So now I have to take care of my mom no matter what she does to me. And that's kind of what I did. And I still kind of do that with her. But it comes from a different place today. Because she's still sick. She didn't have the beauty of a program like Alcoholics Anonymous to save her. I can only keep being an example to her. And I know that, like I said, she is sick, and I was sick, right? I mean, you'll hear about all the terrible things I did and my addiction and the terrible things I did to my children. I was sick too. So if I have to believe that for me, I have to believe that for her. And if I want grace and forgiveness, I have to offer it. Living that way, growing up that way, you know what, let me preface this by saying I had an amazing grandmother. And she was the bee's knees, and she just was enchanting. And I spent a lot of time with her, and she taught me how to paint with coffee and icing. And my grandparents had a boat we spent most of our summers on, which was amazing being on the boat and being with her. But it also was a time where my father and mother are stuck on a boat with my grandmother and my grandfather. And so they had to act like real parents. So I had parents while we were on the boat, and she was my refuge. And she was the only person for a long time where I could be around and I could have maybe an inkling of idea what like happiness was like. And I think about her every day. I have to. I named a kid after her, so I kind of think about her every day. But I do think about her all the time. I'm crying because I love her. With that, and I did have this beautiful, wonderful thing in my life. I did. And I did have this boat, which was wonderful. And my mother was really, really great at, like, traditions, like how we woke up for Christmas and how all of that was done, and Easter and birthdays and the Beatles' birthday song that would be played on the record player when you blow out your cakes. Like, those were things that held me together, things that you could count on, and moments where things just seemed good and okay. But obviously, in between all that, and for the majority of the time, it was a lot of a lot of terror, truly. So with that growing up, the abuse, the idea of worth and value and those kinds of words didn't have anything to do with me. I couldn't conceive of them. They weren't really words that were spoken about. I mean, your kids, your teenagers, we're not really talking about that. But I imagine, and after, you know, knowing a lot of people, there is a sense of, like, needing to take care of yourself and you know, liking yourself a little bit. And I didn't have any of that. And not sure letting people treat you poorly. And I let everybody treat me badly. I let it happen. That's important. Because things that happened after that, things that transpired after that, like relationships that I was in, I keep my phone in front of me, relationships that I was in, very abusive relationships, obviously, because they were just like my how I grew up. I got myself into those relationships. And then, of course, you know, I find other things, and I land myself in rehab, and I'm with this terribly abusive guy, and I find out that I'm pregnant in rehab at 20 years old, and I decided then that I was going to be the best mom and just watch me. So then all of it is a battle, a fight, an ego, and I don't need Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't need anyone, and except for my daughter, Riley. She's still a pain in the butt. She's talking about her guard. But she's 24 now, and in many, many ways, she saved me. There's a daddy long legs coming after me. That's scary enough to me. Sorry, if you love spiders, I'm so sorry. That's how I broke my leg, by the way. It all started with a freaking spider. All of those feelings, again, from, like, growing, it all carried over. So I am now this child's mother, and I'm trying to find value within being this child's mother. But there is, you know, no human power that can relieve us of our insanity. So even though I'm not drinking or drugging, I'm still really, really sick. And my daughter now becomes my higher power, and I find out now, as I'm sober now, that that's not okay. I spent most of my days not being able to wait for the day to end, and then waking up wishing that I wasn't waking up and that the day would just hurry up and end already. I did deeply, desperately love my daughter. I knew that. When I had her, I knew, like, what real love is, and that I didn't have it, and that I needed to make sure that she saw, and now all of my kids, I have three children, that I doted on them, and I paid them attention, and I hugged them, and I kissed them, and I read to them, and I did all of those things. But while I'm doing those things, I'm still kind of disconnected from it. It's like I'm watching me do all these things from the outside. And for a long time, I thought that meant I didn't really love her. You know, that I was not capable of doing it, that I was just faking. I ended up landing myself in North Carolina eventually. After my dad left, I stayed, and I helped raise my sister, and my mom was drinking, and she finally, though, was pulling it together and got a job, and my sister's at college, so I left and went to North Carolina with my oldest. And again, I just said it, you take yourself wherever you go. But I thought this change in location and not having the responsibility of my mother and my sister now would make everything better. And I'm going to live my own life. But it just got worse. And now I am drinking, and I'm drinking a lot. I'm drinking until I black out, and I'm alone with a six-year-old child. Still waiting for every day to end and for them not to begin. And then I meet a guy. He was really cute, and he had dreadlocks like down to here, and I thought it was way too cool for me. And but he wasn't, because he liked me too. And I feel better, and then I'm like, oh, get married. So I married him. I've divorced him. No. Or he divorced me. I probably worked. The latter. I was the worst of you two. Even though he's a jerk. But within that time I started to get sick, and I did get really sick, and I still have that illness today, and I will the rest of my life. But it took many, many years to find out what it was, and I was living on feeding tubes, and I would have seizures, and all the gamut of things went wrong with my body. But within that, they gave me a lot of medicine, buckets of it, buckets. It's obscene. So there you go. And it's okay because it's all prescribed, and I'll just keep crushing it all up and shoving it in my feeding tube with vodka. It's going to be great. And no, I don't have a problem. Somehow I would manage. I did manage to get pregnant. I managed to get pregnant twice and two more times. And I would stop immediately, and I thought I had morning sickness. Nope. I was withdrawing. And I couldn't wait to be done nursing so that I could, you know, it was like literally on a calendar the day I would call the doctor to get my medicine back. But I don't have a problem. And then I have Elsie, and the same thing, and I don't have a problem. And then I started to think, maybe I do have a problem. Maybe I just don't really need this stuff anymore. And why I had that thought, I don't know. So I thought, well, let's just sell it. That'll be smart. Being a freaking soccer mom with feeding tubes is going to be out there, you know, wheeling and dealing. But what ended up happening there is rather I kept having to buy my alcohol back. They gave me something else. Actually, my ex-husband said, here, just do this and I'll have to buy it back. And then that was it. So now I'm on other forms of alcohol until I finally found my home with the two things that I like, my yin and yang, and there is no God, and there is no hope, and I am disconnected from everything and everyone, and that feeling I had with my oldest daughter is the same feeling I had with my two little ones, and before I know it, I am, it always sucks to say, like I've dealt with it, and my kids and I have talked about it and dealt with it, and we've prayed about it, and we've all processed it together, but it's still so hard to have to say that, like, I abandoned my children, would leave them for months at a time, missing birthdays, thinking that I had just seen them. And then being told, no, a school's about to start. You haven't seen them since May, June. Within all of this, I'm getting sober. I'm going to jail. I'm going back out. I'm going back to jail. I'm getting sober. And it was a despicable, heartbreaking, gut-wrenching life. And not so much because I was in pain, but because, like, I knew the pain that I was causing everybody else. It took, obviously, many times for me to finally figure it out. I got a sponsor who I had known for years. She was actually a tech at rehab, and you can't sponsor somebody with, you know, so many years. And then this last time I came out of treatment, my one brother whisked me away. He's like, nope, you're out of here. You're going to treatment in Marlborough, New Jersey. And he held me there until our house opened afterwards. After treatment, he held me there until in a hotel until the recovery house bed opened up. And I thought that they had all, like, left me. I thought they were all gone, my family. But he wanted me to come clean about something else because they all knew And he knew. He somehow knew, because he's definitely not one of us. He actually said to me, I knew you had to be powerless, because this is not you. The kind of mother I saw in you, you had to be powerless. And it blew me away that he used those words. And he said, but you're not going to get better until you tell the truth. Okay. So while I was out there, I ended up finding one place to go for my alcohol eventually. And it was a whole process, the whole grooming process, you know, as I look in retrospect. And this precedes like other events like this. I mean, for example, my first drink, I don't remember when I was roofied and raped. But I knew when I woke up in the hospital, all I wanted was a drink. So the monster was woken up. And I had more events like that throughout my life and throughout my addiction. But then eventually I was in that house, at that house I kept going to, where I just... See, my morality was gone. The care for my safety or my well-being was gone. My care for anybody else was gone. Nothing else mattered. Nothing else mattered. And I didn't ever try to kill myself, but I didn't want to live. And I didn't care if I died. And I figured everybody would be fine without me anyway. The kids haven't seen me in how long? They're fine. They've probably already gotten used to it. Like, this is the stuff I would tell myself. So eventually, at this house that I would go to, one night I didn't come out. And I was in there for a month and a half, and I was getting trafficked. I spent the next year just... I was picked up. We don't even have an hour for me to tell you how amazing that the story is. Just believe me, that God was in it the whole time. Somehow, Fall Township Police worked their way into Trenton and found me at this house and pulled me out of there. And then I went to cardiac arrest twice. If I would have died in that house, which I would have, they would have thrown me in an alley to rot. And I went from there to treatment, and I did not stay sober. But I had this inkling that maybe I'm wrong about everything. And then that's when my brother, shortly after, because I picked right back up, said, no, you got to come with me. And he went and made me tell the truth and tell the authorities. And that opened Pandora's box, and I started talking about a lot of other things. So this was like, there's God all throughout my story. My grandmother is part of that story. Having other people try to intervene in my family, but it not being allowed to happen. That is, because here's the thing. What goes on and what happened to me and the things that I did, like lying, cheating, stealing, abandoning my children, stealing cars, robbing everybody's shed. I mean, you name it, I did it. Go to a movie theater parking lot, they're gold mine, those cars. And that was all my will, and what happened to me by them was their will, and it was never God's will. God never wanted any of that for me. And he definitely didn't want any of that for my children. He didn't want any of that for my mother. But that's what people do on this earth that we walk on. And it was the steps that taught me that, the sponsor that I finally got to be able to ask to be my sponsor. And sitting with her, she had a way of just drawing me in. And I wouldn't really talk, but she was drawing me in. And I thought, maybe this God that I thought had forsaken me throughout all of this. You know, he has the ones that are good, the ones that are bad, the ones he chooses, the ones he doesn't. I was on the forsaken list. I decided to think maybe I was wrong. And I decided, like, when I got to step three, okay, I don't think this God loves me. Like, I think you might be wrong, but if I think you might be wrong, that means there's a chance I'm wrong. So, okay, I'll say the prayer. I'll give it up. I'll give it up to the idea that I might be wrong. And as I continued through the steps, that idea started to expand and expand. And she had me say to myself, or say to God over and over again every day, help me see myself and the world through your eyes. Help me be who you want me to be. And that's how I started. That's how prayer started for me. It is only 8:30, by the way. Jesus Christ. Thanks. So that little bit of a prayer that was annoying to me, uncomfortable to say, I did have an idea. Like, I did believe that there was God. Again, like I said, I didn't believe that God was there for me. I believed, I didn't think he believed in me. My father used to tell me that he was God. I mean, he used God to control me, to keep me in my place. I mean, baptized when I was 6 and told me I was going to hell. So, like, this God thing is, I can't wrap my head around it. But she kept telling me that maybe he's alone. And she taught me about will. And she taught me about my will. She taught me about surrender. And she taught me about being sick. And she told me, you're not a bad mom. You're a sick mom. Like, you just need to get better. And so I gave myself up to a God I didn't believe in. I gave myself up to an idea. And I knew I had to start getting honest. So at least what I had at this point was like that gift of desperation that everybody says. And I wasn't desperate for myself. I wasn't desperate to make myself better and my life better for me. Because frankly, I didn't really matter to me. But my kids, she explained to me that although I am not abusing them like that, I am still abusing them by abusing myself. She was right. When you're like pushing your kids out of the way of the door and trying to shut the door in front of them just so you can get out of hell, like, just get out of my way. I need to go. And then you go away for weeks. That's abuse. And that's what I was doing. I knew I just couldn't do that to them anymore, so I had to figure this shit out. Sorry. So I just kept trucking along, and once that was 46 pages long, yeah, I was like, oh, you want the truth? You're going to get it. Here it comes. And it took us a number of days to get through my fifth step, and I did not feel better after the fact. I did, though, ironically fall asleep and when I was supposed to meditate. But for me, that was great because I didn't really sleep. A couple hours here, a couple hours there. Because I was all tied up in knots, right? I had a lot of stuff under the surface just waiting, just seething and waiting to come back up and destroy me again. So I didn't have this fantastic feeling. I didn't. The skies didn't light up. I wasn't relieved. I felt embarrassed. I felt vulnerable. I felt raw. I was able to fall asleep. Once I was able to do that and really tell the truth to the best of my ability, right? Because you're in early sobriety, there's a lot of things you don't remember. Or you remember things the wrong way. Once I did that, I was able to start taking my kids. I stayed in the recovery house, and my kids, believe me, like, listen to this. My kids ended up living in the recovery house with me. Legit. I started with a night, and I always wanted to get loaded on Thursday. And why was I wanting to get loaded on Thursday? I couldn't figure it out. And then months later, my sponsor's like, Steve, what happens on Friday? Like, I get the kids for the night. Yeah, dude. That's why you always want to get loaded on Thursday. Like, that's how, like, far gone we are in the beginning. But that one day turned into 2 days, turned into, before we know it, The kids were literally living with it. Chelsea knows, where is she? Chelsea knows. She came over to do step work in this room, and there's three beds, and there are toys, and there are books, and all of that stuff. As long as I manage the house well, it's sure your kids can stay here. And their father is, you know, he's something. And he was more than willing. I mean, he always dropped them. He didn't care what the condition I was in to drop the kids off to me. So he clearly did not care if they lived in a recovery house. And I was just fine with that. And the stories my kids have to tell, the things they remember, oh my God. But once I was able to relieve myself of those things, then eventually, right, it's time to make amends and start to relieve the other people in your life. But I saw a lot of work to do with God. And I had had that initial spiritual experience, saying that same prayer, those two sentences, where I was like just completely covered in God. I knew He was right there in the room. It was, everything went silent. And He was there. But it still wasn't enough. Because you don't hold on to that. You don't hold on to that. Something happens. It doesn't matter what it is. You get distracted. You start moving on. And now you're living in fear and regret and anger and resentment. And this person did this and you did that. Or you think about this whole thing. You know, every day we do that, right? Every day we have to draw ourselves back. No matter how much time sober we have. But I kept seeking and I kept searching. And I didn't like how I would feel when I would start to go backwards. I didn't like how that felt, and that feeling terrified me. And everybody says, get sober for yourself. Well, that was not the case for me. As I was just talking about, I got sober for my kids. The result of getting sober for my kids in time was that I wanted to be sober for me. And then being sober for me, I can now do what I need to do for my kids. I was able to sit with my brothers and my sister and my mother and other people in my life and tell them what I think I did, everything that I could remember, and be ready to hear the response and be ready to deal with that. And like I said, a lot of that turned into revelation for all of us. That brought us all so much closer together. My sister's gotten really weird with COVID and stuff, but not weird, but very cautious with her itty bitty, and I understand. But outside of that, we are all, so we haven't really seen her, but besides that, we are all really close. And my sister-in-law hated me more than anybody would hate anybody. And her and I are now like best friends. We talk almost every day. My brother and my sister, and my sister-in-law, they all fought for me in court against my ex for the kids. And they wanted me nowhere near my children. I wasn't allowed on my brother's sidewalk. I was allowed to drop the kids off, but I wasn't even, like, I had to, the grass part, yeah, the curb and the sidewalk, I wasn't allowed to touch the grass. I mean, he stood there and pointed. And now I just show up at their house and I steal his pressure washer and clean my windows. I did that yesterday. As a matter of fact. And the more I do this and the more I do this, oh, there's a clock right there. I get it. Okay. Yeah, right. The more I do these things, the closer I'm feeling to something that I don't understand, to something that I can't see and I can't touch, but I know I can feel, to something that I can't tangibly grab a hold onto, but I know is working through these experiences that I'm having with other people, the experiences I'm listening to from other people when I'm sitting in the rooms, the experiences that I'm just having in general in separate different moments, whether it's you know, you're thinking about something, something's weighing heavy on your heart, and then you drive by and there's like a sign on the side of the road that answers that question for you. Or even if it doesn't answer a question, lets you know that God is with you, that you are not alone. I felt alone my whole life, all the way up until 4.5 years ago. And maybe a little into the 4.5 years ago, because I couldn't have quite fought it yet. I always felt completely alone. I always felt disconnected. I always felt like I was on the outside. It didn't matter how good everything looked on the surface. I was so broken. And I broke everybody else around because of it. I had no excuses. It doesn't matter what happened to me. It doesn't matter that I was sexually abused. It doesn't matter that I was trafficked. None of those things in between that happened matter. I had no excuse to be doing what I was doing, and I had to own that. I had to take responsibility. It was my job. I got myself to that house. I kept going to that place. I'm the one that gave up on the idea of safety or caring for myself. I did that. Sure, what they did was wrong, obviously. But to this day, I have forgiven them. On Father's Day this year, I told my dad I forgive him. And I'm crying because it feels good. He's annoying and I don't want to talk to him a lot, but I don't have to. Forgiveness doesn't equal reunion, but it does mean that I can be free. I used to talk about forgiving him. I used to think I forgave him, but I hadn't actually said it to him, and I just needed to, and I did, and it is done. Today, because I went through the steps, because I prayed, because I was obedient to the decision to pray. Obedience is a strong word, I know, but I had to be. I had to be convicted and obedient to the decision to pray, because if I didn't remain to pray, I was not going to remain in AA. Through COVID, I got to homeschool my children. I got to do that. They lived with me, and I did it well. I was connected, and I prayed a lot. Couldn't get to meetings. At the end of every day for me, it is God, and I know people get wonky when it comes to a higher power, but for me, if I don't have a higher power, I'm not here. And I have seen God do what he does. I have felt God do what he does. I today have custody of my children. I today can take other people through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have something to say. I have something to offer because I pray and I ask for help and guidance, the words and the wisdom of God to do these things. Every day I ask God to be help me be obedient, willing, and aware. I've been in like a really ugly relationship still through recovery, and it was still kind of my old stuff, like leading into like the new life, and I finally worked my way out of that. And when I finally, it was through prayer and writing and journaling and reading and talking and sharing and being honest and telling the truth about the ugly things and the scary things and my fault and how ugly I could get and all of that stuff, I finally left that situation. And when I made that decision, this is just incredible. Like, I never gave up on the most beautiful relationship in my life, and that's my relationship with God, above all other relationships, above my relationship with my children, because I can't have that with my kids if I don't have this with him. And I stuck it out with God, and God stuck it out with me. And when I made a decision that I knew was deep in my heart the whole time, and I wasn't listening to God, I listened, and the house showed up. And a 2.9 interest rate, by the way, for a car showed up. No business getting that. None. So that showed up. Because my other car, the hood flipped up. It was a whole thing. I never had anything but a clunker my whole life. So that shows up. My church found, people found out that I was in the process, and thousands of dollars were donated to me and the kids to help us get started on our feet. When COVID hit, I had just before that lost a job, and I thought my life was over. And when I get this job, COVID hits, and I can work from home and take care of my kids. I make enough money because of that car with the 2.9 interest rate. I mean, we're talking about stuff, but without the car, I can't get to the job. And without the job, I can't afford the car or the house. And without all of those things, I don't have a home to give to my children. And now today, I'm raising my kids, and I have custody of my kids, and they can count on me, and they trust me, and we're close. And they tell me, I think everything will be turning 13. I don't want to know some stuff. The other one's 10. It's love time. And I have friends and relationships and people that count on me and come to me for help, or love, or support, or time. I love my mom. I love her. I see her through the stuff because I have forgiven her. None of this would be possible if I didn't do this wholly and thoroughly and deeply. And for me, I had to keep going back to it and back to it and back to it again, because I have this like thing here telling me that something's wrong, something's missing. And I would go back to my sponsor and we would do more stuff. And I never, ever, even though I didn't believe what I was saying in the beginning, I never stopped praying. I never stopped. You know, I chased for a long time. I chased after all the wrong things, the things that I thought I needed, the things I thought I wanted, the things I absolutely didn't need, but I craved and couldn't live without. And instead, I now chase my relationship with God, because when I do that, everything else is much better. And, you know, just sit on my sun porch of my house in the morning and take that time to journal and write and read. And I'm just constantly seeking and searching the depth of that relationship. Like, my story is like fantastical, and you'll hear like, oh, you're so brave and you're so courageous for going through all of that. I'm not. I didn't have a choice. I was forced into it. A lot of that stuff. And it definitely wasn't me being courageous to rise above it. I didn't do that. Not on my own. On my own, I'm a junkie that lives in the Trenton train station, that stays in crack houses, that abandons her children, that robs and steals from everyone in her neighborhood and surrounding neighborhoods, because I was usually on foot. That's me on my own. That's me without God. That's who I am. But with God, I get to, when I give it away, I'm lifted up. When I bend low, He raises me up. So when I am humble and I give it all away, and it sounds like an oxymoron every time you say it, but it's so true. Here's the power. I'm here. If I plug into the power, guess what I've got? And it is just, I don't know, everything sounds like it's corny, but corny things are said, you know, and all that are said all the time because they're true. It is a beautiful life. It is I would hear people say this, I would be so annoyed. Life beyond your wildest dreams. There, I said it. This weekend, okay, I got approved for an Airbnb. I did. My son's going to be 13, and I finally told them last year, okay, guys, I'm done feeling guilty for having abandoned you. I'm done spending $1,000 on birthday parties. And they were both kind of cool with it. And they're cool with, like, us talking like that. Like, we talk about everything. They remember things. We even laugh about some stuff. Kind of sick. But they're in therapy. I'm in therapy. But we are very, very open about it all. So this year, I said, they're getting experiences, not parties. And we're going to do stuff. And that's what it's going to be for the rest of forever. You're going to do stuff. And my son wanted to go whitewater rafting. So I got an Airbnb at Coconut. And we're going whitewater rafting. And we're going to come home and have ice cream cake with his cousins and aunts and uncles. And that is awesome. And I'm planning a trip to Niagara Falls for my daughter's birthday. Because today we get to do things. We get to participate. We get to live in the world. We get to be part of life. And the world is going to fail us a million times over. And I'll look around God all the time to see what the world is telling me. And I'll get filled up with fear and resentment and insecurities and all that stuff because I'm doing this when God's right in front of me. And that's why it's so important for this alcoholic to remain to pray every single day. And it's rolling around in my head. When I got other things rolling around in my head like rocks in a dryer, I got to talk to God. And it isn't, it's just like a conversation. It's just, even when I'm just in my head, I know that God is with me in there, in that place. I'm not just, my mind isn't just wandering. I don't believe that my mind is ever just wandering. I believe it's always being heard. I really hope that out of anything I've said, you don't think of this story as my story, because it's not. My story is God's story, because I wouldn't be standing up here without him. And I can't help but think and feel that so many of us, I think all of us, end up in the room. We go through what we go through. We end up in the room. And if you're willing, not God willing, if you're willing to stay sober, then this is what God had meant for you. So that you can share this beautiful thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and the power of this unseen force can have on us, in us, around us. And that hour kind of went by pretty quick once we hit like 8:30. You know? I actually said, like, can we get this going? And thank God it was playing. He did it. I also hope that you don't think of my story as some like crazy movie you heard about. Because I get that a lot when I like, oh my God, it's like a movie. You should write a book. And maybe I should. And go on Oprah or something after I write the book. But the point of the story is not that I was beaten and molested and raped and all of those things. That's not the point of the story. The point of me standing up here talking to you is that you can see that is not who I am, and that today I know whose I am, and I belong to my higher power, and my higher power has the guys put together a book for these steps so that we can know that we need God, and then for the rest of the time and the rest of the days of our lives, we hopefully continue to seek him so that we can stay sober. That's all I got. Bye, can I leave now?